"That's it," said Moxie. "There wasn't any. Unfortunately, you had invited me to one of Los Angeles' most posh eateries." "Oh, that time." "That time?" "Yes." "I wouldn't mind getting my watch back sometime, the one the restaurant took." "A Piaget, wasn't it?"
"With little diamonds."
Fletch asked, "What time is it?" She put herself on her stomach.
"Who cares?"
Fletch said, "Exactly." Moxie inhaled slowly and exhaled with a great sigh. "Oh, Fletch. Oh, Fletch, you never change." He smiled at her, showing her all his front teeth. "I just get better."
"Worse. So what did you do with all this money you stole?"
"I didn't steal it."
"It just fell into your lap?"
"Something like that. Long story. The money was on its way to South America, see, so I went with it. I'm very big on seeing actions completed, essential to my psyche."
"Then how come you haven't finished writing the biography of Edgar Arthur Tharp?"
"I'm working on it. I was in South America. I didn't know what to do with the money. Maybe I felt a little badly about having it. Maybe I was trying to get rid of it. So I bought gold with it."
"Oh, no."
"I did."
"And the price of gold shot up?"
"Someone mentioned that to me in a bar, so I felt worse. I got rid of the gold, quick. Yuck. I hated the oil companies, thought they were giving the world a royal screwin'. They were bound to get their comeuppance."
"So you put your money into oil companies?"
"Yes, I did."
"And their value shot up?"
"So I heard. That made me feel worse."
"I can believe."
"I got rid of that yucky stuff as quick as I could. I've done terribly."
"And where's the money now?"
"Well, I decided my investment policy wasn't very sound. Very responsible, you know what I mean? I'd been buying things I didn't like."
"So you decided to buy things you did like?"
"I decided to use the money to help out instead of hinder. I heard General Motors was having such a tough time nobody was buying its stock."
"So you bought General Motors?"
"So I bought General Motors. And the cable electronic companies looked risky, so I put some money into them."
"Good Lord, Fletch. God, you're so incompetent."
"Well, I never said I was any good with money."
"You should have taken a course. How to invest."
"Yes," Fletch said, "I suppose I should have."
"You just never cared about money."
"No," said Fletch, "I don't." When they got to the Gulf Stream, she went overboard and he lowered the sails and, except for the light lines to the boat he tied to his ankles, he got naked too and went overboard and they played and made love in the water. Only the light drifting boat kept pulling him away from her by the ankles and he kept getting too much water up his nose and they both laughed so hard they ran out of breath and nearly drowned. But they did succeed, but they were slow to leave the water and climb back into the boat anyway. "As long as we're talking about money," he said.
"Is this still nice talk?"
"Jumping Cow Productions Incorporated," he said. They had sailed back to an empty beach and run the catamaran up onto the fine sand. They took their food and drinks ashore and had a picnic. The drinks were very warm, but they drank them anyway for the sake of putting fluid into their bodies. The sandwiches had dried out. Mostly they ate the fruit. After eating, they lay in the sand. It was late enough in the afternoon, and there were enough passing clouds so the sun would not burn their tanned skin. Fletch waited a long while. Finally, she put herself on her side, and she put her hand on his hip, and he put himself on his side as well, and put his hand on his head. Her face told him he had her attention, but she did not expect to talk about money at this time. "Tell me, Moxie," he said, "what does the cow jump over?"
"The moon," she answered easily.
Then her face changed. She looked at him as if he had struck her. Then she rolled over onto her back. She covered her eyes with one hand.
"Mooney," she groaned.
"Right, Moxie Mooney." She continued to lay flat on her back beside him on the sand, her hand covering her eyes from the sun. "You are sole proprietor of Jumping Cow Productions Incorporated. Martin Satterley called me this morning."
"Good,"
she rolled onto her stomach.
I'll close that goddamned movie down faster than anything you ever saw.
Midsummer Night's Madness?
Feeney to Midsummer Night's Madness. To Edith Howell, Cy Collar, Jeff McKenzie, Jerry Littleford, Talcott Cross, the whole damned bunch of 'em. Goodbye to that stupid script. Goodbye to Route 41.
I take it you did not know you are sole proprietor of Jumping Cow Productions.
I did not. I certainly did not.
Moxie, when you went into Peterman's office a couple of weeks ago, what did you actually learn? What did you actually find out that upset you so, you know, enough to cause you to ask me to meet you here?
I couldn't find any real tax reports. I kept asking the staff for the tax files. They kept bringing me folder after folder with all this crazy stuff in them, loan agreements with banks in Honduras and Switzerland and Mexico. I didn't know what it all meant, but I got madder and madder.
Her voice dropped.
Or more and more scared.
Fletch lay back on the sand, folding his hands behind his head. Marty couldn't do a very thorough job of looking at your financial records. 4 o'clock this morning, the police came in and took them all.
Oh, God, the police have my financial records?
You knew they...
I didn't know anything, Fletch!
Moxie snapped. She pounded her fist on the sand.
Damn!
She got up and walked at an angle down the beach to the water's edge and then kept walking along the water. After a long while, when she didn't come back, he took their garbage back to the boat and turned it around in the light surf and otherwise prepared for departure. Then he sat on one of the hulls and waited while Moxie walked back down the beach. They launched the boat together. Moxie? Again they were sailing, the low sun at their stern. She sat, the picture of dejection, chin on hand, elbow on knee.
You know the guy who owns the Blue House?
No, how could I?
His name is Ted Sills. You said yesterday you didn't know him.
I don't.
Apparently you are a co-owner with Ted Sills of a Florida horse farm. She wrinkled her face at him. There was salt on her skin and a small dab of sand on one cheekbone.
We're partners in something?
Five Aces Farm, Ocala, Florida. She shrugged.
News to me.
I guess he was a friend of Steve Peterman's.
Listen, Fletch.
She sounded tired and angry and tired of being angry.
Why don't you just give it to me in simple?
Wish I could. As I told you, Marty didn't get very far into your records when the cops arrived. He seems to agree with your two main fears, that you are in tax trouble, that you do owe huge and unlikely sums of money to banks all over the world.
Moxie Mooney looked all over the horizon. Which way did you say Cuba is?
He pointed. That way.
You want to come with me, or should I start swimming?
An awful lot of inexplicable financial activity has been going on under your name.
Inexplicable? And you expect me to explain?
Marty couldn't explain it. He couldn't understand it.
Is it your friend Marty's opinion that something crooked has been going on?
He was trying not to have an opinion.
But he had to try hard, right?
Right. Fletch hitched in the main sheet.
He seemed to feel all that much activity couldn't have been going on without your knowing about it.
The red light from the setting sun, full in her face, Moxie just stared at Fletch. Fletch said quietly, "In other words, Moxie, chances are pretty good your average judge is going to believe you're lying."
"Lying," she said.
"About everything."
She looked at the paper sandwich wrappers and empty soda cans on the deck of the cockpit.
"The way you were lying this morning about all your money?"
Fletch chuckled.
"Yeah."
"Come on, Fletch, games are games. This isn't fun."
She studied the junk in the bottom of the boat a long time. Then she put her hand on his knee.
"Hey, Fletch, thanks for the nice day."
"Nice to make your acquaintance," he said.
He was sailing for the right beach. Leaving that morning, he had lined the beach up with the Martello Towers.
"In other words," Moxie said, "going through my financial records, the cops are going to find I had tons of reasons for killing Steve Peterman."
"It looks that way."
The centerboard was up. Near the beach, Fletch was looking for the heads of late swimmers on the water.
Fletch.
Moxie shivered.
Please find someone else to pin this murder on.
I'm trying, babe, Fletch said. I'm trying.
It was dark, and walking through the side streets in her loose beach wrap, her head down, Moxie attracted no attention.
Fletch said, There's one other small matter.
Boy, you're really giving it to me today. I thought we were just going to talk about happy things.
I got you out of the house just so we could talk.
You took me sailing so you could beat up on me.
Your father told me about your going to school in England.
Quietly, Moxie said, You knew I went to school in England almost 2 years.
I never knew why.
Freddie was being paternal that year, wanted me near him.
But he wasn't in England that year.
He was supposed to be. His schedule got changed.
Moxie... Fletch took her hand. Hey, he said. Your father said something about your drama coach at school getting murdered.
Her hand went limp in his. I was only 14.
God, what does that mean?
She pulled her hand from his. It means Freddie didn't think I needed all that pressure on me at the age of 14.
Pressure? Pressure?
She veered on the rough sidewalk. They were then on a dark, empty side street. She was walking a meter away from him.
Do you think I murdered Mr. Hodes?
Think? I don't think anything. I didn't even know the guy's name.
He was a little shit, Moxie muttered.
I think you were gotten out of town damned fast, way out of the country, and you went.
I was 14, for God's sake.
They'd stopped walking.
I didn't mind going to school in England. It sounded cool.
I ask you if you murdered somebody, and all you say is you were 14.
Is that what you think? You think I murdered the birdie drama coach?
I don't know what to think. I hate what I think. Why don't you answer me?
Across the sidewalk, her eyes glowered.
Think what you want, Fletcher.
She began to walk. She walked with her fists clenched at her sides. She walked ahead of him all the way to the house. They approached the blue house from the rear.
Moxie, well ahead of him, head down, zipped through the back gate into the garden.
When Fletch got to the back gate, Lopez was coming through with a rubbish barrel.
Ah, Fletch said, tomorrow's the day the rubbish gets picked up.
Lopez grinned at him.
A lot of broken glass, Mr. Fletcher. They threw a lot of stones.
I know. Any real damage?
No, it's all cleaned up. Tomorrow I will start replacing the windows which were broken.
On top of the barrel that Lopez had just set down were three empty apple juice bottles.
Sorry about this morning, Fletch said. All the noise, damage, mess. Guess I'm not a very good tenant.
Lopez's grin grew even broader.
It's fun, he said. This house is empty so much. The excitement is good. Don't think about it.
Chapter 27 How many stitches? Fletch asked. In the hospital bed, Stella Littleford didn't look any more sallow than usual. The surgical dressing on her forehead was not as big as Fletch expected. 6 She did not smile. Jerry Littleford sat on a side chair, his feet propped up on the bed. On top of his shorts, he was wearing a hospital johnny. He had left the blue house that morning without a shirt. Apparently, he had not been back to the house since. He also wore paper slippers on his feet.
They're keeping her overnight, Jerry said. Concussion.
I brought you some flowers, Fletch said.
Nurse ate them.
He crossed the room and leaned his back against the windowsill.
What happened this morning anyway? I didn't see. I was on the phone.
There was a riot, Jerry Littleford said dryly.
I went out into the front yard and shook my fist at those dirty bastards and called them dirty bastards, Stella said. Dirty bastards.
Does it hurt to talk?
It does now.
She tried not to laugh.
It didn't this morning.
She got bonked, Jerry said. Someone threw a rum bottle at her.
Someone must have really cared, Fletch said. There was still rum in the bottle.
Good. Stella again tried not to laugh.
"I've never seen you laugh before," Fletch said to her.
"She does everything she's not supposed to do," Jerry said, "when she's not supposed to do it. Like marrying me." Stella's eyes moved slowly to Jerry's face. Fletch could not read the expression in them.
"Question," Fletch said. "Have either of you heard before from these groups? Threatening letters, phone calls, anything?"
Neither answered him.
"I'm just wondering," Fletch said, "how much these groups wanted that film stopped."
Still, neither answered him.
"Hey," Fletch said, "there's been a murder, maybe two. Stella's in bed with a concussion, stitches in her forehead. This morning we saw demonstrations demanding the film be stopped. It's a reasonable question."
Jerry asked, "Has the film been stopped?"
And Fletch didn't answer.
"Have you heard from any of these groups before?"
Jerry put his feet flat on the floor and sat straight in his chair as if about to give testimony in court.
"To be honest, yes."
"Letters?"
"With pamphlets enclosed. Keep the white race pure pamphlets, you know, so you honkies can go a few more centuries without soul."
"There have been phone calls too, Jerry," Stella said.
"Phone calls," Jerry said. "Threats?"
"My black ass will get burned if I make the film. I'll get a shot in the head."
Jerry's eyes roamed over Fletch's face.
"It's hard for a black man to tell a real threat from a normal white man's conversation."
"Did you tell anybody about these threats?"
"Like who?"
"Anybody in authority. Steve Peterman, talk at what's-his-name, Cy Collar, the cops."
"You think I'm crazy? Making this film is my employment. I'm not looking to get unemployed."
"Do you still have any of these letters, pamphlets?"
"Course not. Throw 'em away. Gotta throw 'em away."
"Do you remember any of the names, groups, that sent you these letters?"
"They all have these long, phony names, you know, My Land But Not Your Land Committee Incorporated, Society to Keep 'Em Pickin' Cotton."
"You got a call from a black group, too, Jerry."
"Yes, I did." Jerry smiled. "Some of the brothers want to keep soul to ourselves a few more centuries."
"Jerry," Fletch asked, "sincerely, do you think the production of Midsummer Night's Madness seriously was being threatened by any of these groups, like to the point of murder?"
"I don't know. They're madmen. How can you tell when madmen are serious?"
More quietly, he said,
"Yeah, I think there were murderers in that group this morning that attacked the house. People capable of murder. Plenty of them. That rum bottle could have killed Stella. I just doubt they're up to organizing anything as clever as the murder of Steve Peterman. Whoever got Steve was no dope."
"I guess you're right."
The nurse brought in a vase of roses. There were no other flowers in the room.
"Ah!" Fletch got off the windowsill. "You didn't eat them."
"I had supper at home," the nurse said. "Daffodils."
Fletch was at the door.
"Coming back to the house, Jerry?"
"Sure," he said. "Later."
Chapter 28. In the cool night, Fletch walked around Key West for a while. He found himself in the center of the old commercial district, so he went down the alley to Dirty Harry's. Frederick Mooney was not there. Few were. There was no band playing either. He sat at the bar and ordered a beer. A clock he had seen said 11:10, but clocks in Key West are not expected to tell the real time. Clocks in Key West are only meant to substantiate unreality. A dog, a black dog, a large black dog, walked through the bar at the heels of a man who came through a door on the second story and down a spiral staircase.
"What's that dog's name?" Fletch asked the young woman behind the bar.
"That's Emperor. Isn't he a nice dog?"
"Nice dog."
Fletch sipped his beer. He did not want the beer. The early morning phone call from Satterley, the demonstrations, the day of sailing and swimming in the wind and sun, made him glad to sit quietly a moment. He thought about Global Cable News and how quickly his phone call had been answered, and he was allowed to speak to that hour's producer because he was a stockholder. It should be the story that counts, not who is calling it in. Anything can be checked out. Your average stockholder is not any more honest or accurate than your average citizen. Fletch decided if he ever had a big story again, he'd call it into Global Cable News under a phony name. It would be an interesting experiment for a stockholder. He wanted to sleep. He left the rest of his beer on the bar. "Nice dog," he said. Chapter 29. Something woke him up. It was dawn. Fletch remained in bed a minute, listening to the purposeful quiet. It was too purposeful. He got out of bed and went out onto the balcony. There were two policemen in the side yard. They looked back up at him. In the dawn, he could see the flashing blue lights of police cars at the front of the house. "Shit," Fletch said. He ran along the balcony against the wall to the back of the house and around the corner. Jerry Littleford was curled up asleep in a hammock. Fletch shook his shoulder. "Jerry, wake up. It may be a bust." Jerry opened one eye to him. "What? A what?" "Were the police there to arrest someone for murder?" "No, there were too many of them. There were now three cops in the backyard." "Were they there because they'd been tipped off there would be another demonstration?" "No, they were in the yard. Some judge had given them a warrant to be on and in the property." "It sure looks like a bust to me," Fletch said quietly. "A bust? Shut up. Get up. Get rid of whatever shit you have." Fletch pulled up on one side of the hammock and Jerry fell out the other side, landing like a panther on braced fingers and toes. "Down the toilet, Jerry. Pronto." In the bedroom, Fletch put on his shorts and shirt. "What's happening?" Moxie said into her pillow. "You might get dressed. The cops are here." Instantly, she sat up. Instantly, there was no sign of sleep in her face. Instead, there was the look of someone cornered, frightened, but who would fight. "I know," Fletch said. "You didn't kill Steve Peterman. Ho-hum." And three policemen were standing on the front porch. When Fletch opened the front door to them, they seemed surprised. They had not rung the bell or knocked. "Good morning," Fletch said. "Welcome to the home of the stars. Donations are tax-deductible." The policemen seemed shy. There were five police cars in the street. The roof lights of three were flashing. Despite the demonstration the day before, the street was clean. Fletch held his hand out to them, palm up. A policeman put a folded paper into Fletch's palm. Nevertheless, he said, "May we come in?" Fletch held their own paper up to them. "Guess this says you may." In the front hall, one of the policemen said, "I'm Sergeant Henning." Fletch shook hands with him. "Fletcher, tenant of this domicile." "We have to search this domicile." "Sure," Fletch said. "Coffee?" The sergeant looked around at all the other policemen coming into the house through the front and back and veranda doors and said, "Sure." In the kitchen, Fletch put a pan of water on the stove and got out two mugs. "Thanks for your help yesterday." "Actual fact, we weren't much help. Got here late. Things had gone too far." "Things like that don't happen here in Key West anyway." "Not on your daily agenda, huh?" "Actual fact, sort of hard to know what to do. Those bimbos are citizens too. Sort of got the right to demonstrate." "Were there any actual arrests?" Fletch spooned instant coffee into the two mugs. From upstairs, he could hear people moving around, furniture being moved. Then he could hear Edith Howell's voice pitched high in indignation. 9. They'll be released this morning." "No one threw that rum bottle at Mrs. Littleford, huh?" The water in the pan was bubbling. "None of the people we arrested did." The sergeant smiled ruefully. "We asked every one of them, we did. Politely, too." Fletch poured the water into the mugs and handed one to the police sergeant. "Any sugar?" the sergeant asked. Fletch nodded to the bowl on the counter. "I need my sugar." The sergeant helped himself. "Coffee and sugar. That's what keeps me bad-tempered." Two other policemen came into the kitchen and began searching through it. "Appreciate it if you wouldn't make too much of a mess," Fletch said. "No, Mrs. Lopez?" "Sure," a cop said. "She'll have to clean it up." He went out onto the back porch with his coffee. The sergeant followed him.
Can you tell me why you're searching the house? Fletch asked.
The sergeant shrugged.
Illegal substances.
Yeah, but why? What's the evidence you had to get a warrant?
It was good enough for the judge. That sure is a nice banyan tree. I haven't been in this house in years.
He grinned at Fletch.
You in the movies, too?
No.
Just one of those cats who likes to associate with movie people, huh?
Yeah, a hanger-on.
It must be sort of disappointing, seeing these people up close. I mean, when no one's writing their lines for them, no one's directing how they act, I'd rather leave them on the screen.
I'm sure they'd rather be left on the screen.
That Mr. Mooney sure is one big drunk. Seen him downtown. He needs a keeper.
He's a great man.
One of our patrolmen drove him home the other night, first night you were here.
Thank you.
Chuck said Mooney recited all the way home. The sergeant chuckled. Something about Jesse James being due in town. Better watch out for him.
The sergeant drank some coffee. Upstairs, Edith Howell was exclaiming, proclaiming, declaiming.
This whole country's drunk, stoned on something.
Whole world.
The people have discovered drugs. Not enough to do anymore. Machines do the hard work. Recreational drugs, we're calling them now. Baseball is recreation. Fishing. Too much time.
Not everyone can go fishing. Not everyone can go to baseball.
The whole damned world stoned on one thing or another.
Saying nothing, a policeman held the back door open. His eyes were bloodshot.
The sergeant left his coffee mug on the kitchen counter. The kitchen was really very clean.
John Meade was standing in the front hall. A policeman was standing beside him. John Meade was wearing gray slacks and brown loafers and a blue button-down shirt and handcuffs. He smiled at Fletch.
Ludes.
Sorry, John, said Fletch. I never thought of you.
Brought him back from New York.
The sergeant took a tin container from the policeman.
Quaaludes, the sergeant said. A controlled substance. You have a prescription, Mr. Meade?
My doctor died, John Meade said. 11 years ago.
Sorry to hear that. I sure liked you in Easy River.
So did I, said John Meade.
The sergeant was examining the tin box.
You sure didn't get this from any legitimate source, Mr. Meade. You're supporting the bad guys, actual fact.
Other police were coming into the front hall.
Hey, Sergeant, Fletch said. Does this have to happen? Do you have to take Mr. Meade in?
Yeah, Sergeant Hennings said.
Too many witnesses. Too many cops around.
Chapter 30. Fletch retreated to the small study at the back of the Blue House. On the front stairs, Edith Howell was screaming her rage that the police had taken John Meade away in handcuffs. She was screaming at Frederick Mooney to go do something about it. There had not been a sound from Frederick Mooney. Fletch wasn't even sure he was in the house. Edith Howell was dressed in blue silk pajamas, blue silk slippers, and a blue silk robe. Her hair was in pin curls and her face clotted with cream. Cy Collar's head had appeared over the second-floor banister, looking painfully hungover. Lopez and Jerry Littleford were in the backyard throwing a tennis ball back and forth. Mrs. Lopez was in the kitchen making real coffee, starting breakfast. Neither Jeffrey McKenzie nor Moxie had come down.